difficult to recover from last night when a potential winning jumper by Brad Miller was overturned following a replay review. The Blackhawks are looking for their fifth straight home win tonight as they meet the Colorado Avalanche in the third of four games this season. In-state rivals Illinois and Northwestern will play for a new trophy on Saturday. The Land of Lincoln, shaped like Abe's hat, has replaced the now-retired Sweet Sue Tomahawk. Illinois leads the series 52-45-5. NCAA basketball officials will start calling fouls on secondary defenders under the basket this season in an effort to curb injuries. Another new rule will let the opposing coach choose someone who's on the floor to shoot a free throw in place of an injured player. And after missing the 100 butterfly final, Michael Phelps qualified for the 200-meter medley final at a short course World Cup meet. It's the third final Phelps has missed at the Stockholm meet, where he's been wearing an old-style swimsuit that will become standard next year, while most swimmers at this meet are using faster, high-tech suits. That's a look at sports.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. There are no substitutes for donated blood. Blood donation takes 45 minutes and saves lives. Information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org.
To mark today, Veterans Day, Senate Democrats had hoped to pass legislation helping caregivers of disabled American veterans from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But efforts this week to consider that bill ran into opposition from one Republican senator, Oklahoma's Tom Coburn. Here's NPR's David Wellnow.
The crucial meeting where the deal was set was in Geneva on October 1st. Iran's top nuclear negotiator was there, along with European, Russian, and Chinese diplomats. The U.S. was represented by an undersecretary of state. The problem facing the Iranians is their research reactor in Tehran, which...
So we have the wrong report there. My apologies for that. We'll look into that and find out what's happened and see if we can get the right report up and running this afternoon. So let's go to another piece having to do with this Veterans Day. Throughout this day, NPR has been playing voices of veterans about their experiences coming home from war. NPR's Habiba Noshin has this story of a soldier's return from Vietnam.
Ed Edmondson was on Capitol Hill yesterday.
And so we have another problem there. Let's have a little musical interlude and we'll see if we can straighten things out. It's 2:44. California has a new big bank which grew not out of success but out of failure. East West Bank just grew larger after acquiring a failed competitor, United Commercial. Both banks catered to the Chinese American community. From member station KPCC, Brian Watt has more.
United Commercial's 63 branches competed with East West Bank and Cathay General Bank for Chinese American customers. Banking analyst Ken Thomas says East West gets a deal in taking over its chief competitor, but he says Asian American small businesses looking for loans lose a major choice.
Instead of going to, say, a bank in Chinatown, whether in L.A. or New York, and having the choice of three banks that focus on the Asian American community, there's now only going to be two.
United Commercial Bank failed in large part because of bad loans, particularly in the commercial real estate market. The federal government tried to keep it alive last year with nearly $300 million in bailout funds. K.T. Lung is vice president of the Chinese American Chamber of Commerce of Los Angeles. He says Chinese Americans are very selective when looking for a loan.
They always like to shop around, try to shop for the best deal.
But Lung doesn't think United Commercial's collapse will affect competition too much. He is concerned, however, that charities in local Asian communities will miss the support of an additional corporate sponsor. For NPR News, I'm Brian Watt in Los Angeles.
Next, a story about the verdict in the first big trial related to the collapse of the subprime mortgage market. Two former Bear Stearns hedge fund managers were found not guilty yesterday. Ralph Chiaffi and Matthew Tannen were accused of misleading investors about the health of their funds. Investors lost $1.6 billion. From member station WNYC, Lisa Chow reports.
The verdict came relatively quickly. After 7 hours of deliberations, Chiaffi and Tannen looked at the jurors without much expression at first. But as the foreman repeated not guilty for each of the six charges, they both finally broke into a smile. Their wives and even some of their lawyers immediately started to cry. Chiaffi and Tannen didn't speak to reporters afterwards, but Chiaffi's lawyer said he was glad the jurors listened. And Tannen, in a written statement, said, quote, "My family and I are eternally grateful." The U.S. Attorney's Office said it was disappointed with the outcome, but that it accepts the jury's verdict and that enforcing and protecting honesty and integrity in the financial markets will continue to be one of the office's main priorities.
Well, it was really fraud. That's what we were looking at.
Ryan Goolsbee was one of the jurors at the trial.
Were these statements meant fraudulently? Were they trying to deceive investors in terms to make gains for themselves? And we just did not see that.
Goolsbee also criticized the government's use of selected quotes from emails, saying they were taken out of context. Surfane Stimson was another juror.
They were optimistic about their funds. This was their baby. You know, they built this. And I don't think they ultimately believed that this was going to fail.
Daniel Richman is a law professor at Columbia University and a former federal prosecutor in Manhattan. He says the government in this case did not have a cooperator, someone saying, "This is how we planned to commit these crimes." Prosecutors relied more on circumstantial evidence, and Richman says that hurt them.
I think when jurors, in the face of massive financial losses and massive allegations of financial wrongdoing in the economy, probably were surprised to find this was the level of proof the government brought forward.
Richman says the acquittal is a setback for the U.S. Attorney's Office because it undermines its strong record on convictions and its credibility in future cases.
I think it will cause prosecutors to be a lot more careful at the strength of the cases they bring and be very focused on the readiness of jurors to look past massive investor loss.
The defense attorneys clearly won sympathy for their clients. Aram Hong was another juror who had a message for the two men.
If I can talk to Chiaffi and Tannen right now, I would just be like, you know, everybody has hurdles in their life and this is one of yours. Just hopefully they'll be able to bounce back.
Chiaffi and Tannen still face several civil lawsuits by their fund's investors and lenders. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Chow in New York.
If you learned your town was polluted with toxic waste, you'd just want to get it cleaned up. That's not how things have worked out with dioxin contamination in central Michigan. Dioxin has been a problem for at least 30 years, but the Dow Chemical Company, the federal government, and the state of Michigan are just now hashing out final cleanup plans. The Environment Report had Sean Ali tour the area to see the extent of the problem and what's at stake for the rest of us.
I wanted to begin my tour with interviews at Dow's chemical plant in Midland. That's where dioxin and related compounds were created. The dioxins were byproducts of chemical manufacturing. After a month of calls and emails to Dow, a spokeswoman said the company was interested in talking about the future, not the past. But the past is the reason there's a problem now. So I start my tour a bit downstream. Michelle Hurd Riddick picks me up near the plant. She's with the Lone Tree Council, a Michigan environmental group. We follow the Tittabawassee River and the path dioxins took over time.
Yeah, this is Freeland Festival Park. Freeland is kind of like a bedroom community of Midland.
Hurd Riddick says fishing is a huge pastime in Michigan, but dioxin made it complicated.
And there's a fish advisory sign.
Right.
There.
So they're telling you don't eat the fish.
Actually, the signs tell you which fish to avoid and how much to eat or not. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency worries dioxin causes cancer and diseases that affect immune, reproductive, and developmental systems.
Pregnant women shouldn't eat any. Children under a certain age should only eat it once a month.
Fish advisories cropped up in 1978. That's after Dow warned Michigan and the federal government about dioxin in the Tittabawassee River. While the plant's dioxin pollution is well below federal limits, the old dioxins are still around, and they're not just in the river.
Now, where are we coming up here?
This is Immerman Park. This does also sit on the banks of the Tittabawassee River, and it is very frequently flooded.
Floodwaters leave behind contaminated silt. Dioxin's been found in the soil of yards and in parks like this. One worry is that kids would get exposed by getting dirt in their mouths.
Oh, yeah, those are the hand-washing sinks.
Because there's the sign, contamination advisory.
Right.
Avoid contact with soil and river sediment due to dioxin contamination. Please use soap and water to wash off soil or sediment.
Yep.
Other parks and some yards had soil scraped and removed. Dow cleaned up several hot spots in recent years, but Michigan and the U.S. EPA went more of a top-to-bottom effort. That might include a sweep of 50 miles of river and part of the Great Lakes.
This is the Saginaw Bay of Lake Huron. As a child, I came up here a lot. In fact, I look at these bigger trees, and I'm so sure that someplace I have a picture of me by these trees. And because this used to be all beach here.
Herd Riddick is middle-aged now. The dioxin was in rivers and Lake Huron before she was born. No one knew that far back, but residents did learn about the problem 30 years ago. Today, Dow, the U.S. EPA, and Michigan are still debating a final solution.
We've had many, many starts, many starts. If I had a nickel for every time I heard someone say, this is how we're going to achieve this cleanup, I'd be a wealthy woman.
Herd Riddick says everybody in the country ought to watch what happens.
It could play out in your community on another issue.
Maybe not dioxin,
maybe
but
not
something
dioxin,
else.
But something else. You want to know that people that your tax dollars are paying to protect you and do this are the ones that are calling the shots.
A final dioxin cleanup could take more than 10 years. Michelle Herd Riddick says she can wait that long if it's done right. But she says it wouldn't hurt if the cleanup started now. For the Environment Report, I'm Sean Aldi.
Now let's return to our stories involving Veterans Day. To mark today, Veterans Day, Senate Democrats had hoped to pass legislation helping caregivers of disabled American veterans from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. But efforts this week to consider that bill ran into opposition from one Republican senator, Oklahoma's Tom Coburn. Here's NPR's David Wellna.
Ed Edmondson was on Capitol Hill yesterday with his son, Eric Edmondson, an Army specialist who was left a quadriplegic from an IED attack in Iraq 4 years ago. The father said he and his wife have struggled to care for their son. At a news conference, he urged the Senate to pass legislation providing home caregivers like himself a stipend, health insurance, counseling, and a 2-week annual break.
I urge you, I ask you, I beg you to get the caregiver bill passed.
But there's no money to pay for the bill, which is why Oklahoma Republican Tom Coburn put a hold on it.
I sent a letter to every senator at the beginning of this Congress that if you put a bill on the floor and you're going to authorize new spending, you better be putting something with it that's going to decrease the spending to pay for that. And so, therefore, that's the reason for the hold.
Coburn, who's also a physician, insists he too thinks the nation should keep its commitment to veterans.
And I think many of the programs that are in this bill are ideally suited for the problems that our veterans have. What I object to is the fact that we're going to create $3.7 billion worth of spending over the next 5 years and not make any effort whatsoever to eliminate programs that don't have anywhere near the priority that this program does.
Coburn also questions why caregivers of Vietnam and Gulf War veterans are not included. Dick Durbin, the Senate's number two Democrat, is the bill's sponsor. He points out that Coburn is the only senator blocking the bill.
And because of his objection, 6,800 veterans of those served in Iraq and Afghanistan are unable to get this additional care. I know we can't give it to every caregiver. I know it will be limited. And we'll have to make that decision as part of our deliberation as to what we can do. But to say that we should do nothing for these people is to make a mockery of this Veterans Day.
And Majority Leader Harry Reid notes that Coburn did not block bills funding the Iraq War that weren't paid for.
I have no ability to comprehend the illogic of Dr. Coburn.
A vote on breaking Coburn's hold on the bill is expected next week. David Wilna, NPR News.
Next, a voice from a veteran about his experience coming home from war. NPR's Habiba Noshin has this story of a soldier's return from Vietnam.
I'm Lieutenant Colonel Michael Sternfeld. I'm 62 years old. I'm retired from the U.S. Army.
Michael Sternfeld is an Amtrak conductor at Washington's Union Station. What many of his passengers don't know is that he served as a sergeant in Vietnam.
When I came home, when we landed, and there was this cheer went up inside the plane when the wheels touched down in California.
Back on home turf, Sternfeld was handed his discharge papers and given a flu shot. Right after, he headed to the airport.
They were anti-Vietnam protesters, and they couldn't separate the soldier from the war. Little did they realize, probably two-thirds of the people going by in uniform were just as disgusted with the war as they were. My main thrust was to get on the plane and head toward Omaha. I wanted to get back to college. When we came down that old TWA 707, I had one thought of the guys who I had seen killed and of Steve who took his own life. And I said, wow, I'm here. It's time to move on and take advantage of this. Just, oh, what a gift I've been given. That's the best way I can put it. The gift to move on and do something with the rest of your life.
Years later, Sternfeld fought as an Army reservist in the Gulf War, and in 2005, he was back with the Army in Iraq, where he injured his leg. Sternfeld's Army training has come in handy in his job with Amtrak. He says thanks to his military background, his daily trains from Washington to New York always leave on time. Habiba Nasheen, NPR News, Washington.
WILL programs are made possible by Community Concierge Magazine. Every issue includes an event calendar, attractions, and maps, as well as a business and shopping guide. Community Concierge Magazine is distributed throughout East Central Illinois and always presents Champaign-Urbana at its best.
Earth and sky.
We really have very little information about how populations and species respond to climate change.
You're listening to Beth Shapiro, an evolutionary biologist at Penn State University and 2009 winner of a Genius Grant from the MacArthur Foundation. Dr. Shapiro uses ancient DNA dating back over 50,000 years to follow long-lived species through their experience of past climate change.
I think any time we can actually see the beginning, the middle, and the end of